All right. So, settling into your meditation posture. And one of the most basic and seemingly simplistic ideas or instructions for meditation is to try to stay still. Actually, quite a challenge. Once you find a posture that feels balanced and stable, comfortable, just working at holding that posture and applying your mindfulness to that, to just your posture, is a very strong, actually a strong concentration practice. It's easy for the posture to sort of collapse, or for us to get restless, or just to kind of sink into the seat or cushion we're sitting on. So even if holding your posture isn't your primary object of attention, you can just return to that, return to the posture, return awareness to the posture from time to time, just to see how it's holding up. So if you do find that you need to move or to adjust your posture, just do that very slowly, very mindfully. So that it's not just a sudden movement. As you feel the position of the body in this way, then tuning in as well to any other sensations. If there are areas of tension in the body, see if you can breathe into those places and soften, release. Well, this then is awakening our awareness, just the felt experience of life. It starts with the obvious physical sensations, sense impressions. Then, as we tune in more closely, we see that this felt experience goes deeper to reflect our mood, our emotions, our mind states. As our awareness becomes more subtle, this helps us then to see the places where we are clinging, where we are stuck, where we are resisting all the forms of tension and struggle that the mind and body get caught in. This then allows us to discover how to let go on this subtle level. Letting go of the inner tension. The inner striving. The judging. You can use the breath as a grounding sensation, a very clear and present object. This becomes a concentration object. And also a tool for releasing as the inhalation and exhalation open and release through the body. Our practice is to have an object like the breath as a grounding focus, And then notice when the mind wanders, when we get lost, when we get stuck. And then gently return to the breath. All right. I've heard the some of the Thai forest monks say that Ajahn Chah, who was the great, sort of person who really spread the Thai forest tradition in the 20th century, that instead of saying, Ajahn Chah, instead of saying things are impermanent, he would say things are uncertain. And I guess there's a Thai word, I think it's mainay, something like that. Mainay, it's uncertain. And that this would be like his sort of ongoing mantra, something that would come out a lot. And just thinking about how that applies to our current situation, what we do as human beings is we take information and experiences from the past and we project them out into the future to have some sense of where we're going and what's going to happen. And that's one of the ways that we, keep ourselves feeling safe, even though, of course, we're never actually safe. But we're in this time when this novel coronavirus, this new thing that has no precedent, so there's no history that we can draw from. So it's like, as we go along in it, every new piece of information, we try to take that and make that be, project that into the future. So it's like, oh, there's a vaccine, so pretty soon everything will be normal. Oh, people don't want to take the vaccine. Okay, it's not going to be normal. Oh, there's a way that even if you have the vaccine, you can get sick. Oh, I'm going to die. It's difficult. to live in this kind of uncertainty, because there is this thing called plans. I have a plan to get on an airplane in about a month and fly to North Carolina and teach a retreat. And man, every time I watch news, I'm like, I gotta call Southern Dharma and tell them to cancel the retreat. I can't go. I can't do this. But so far I have not canceled it. They're gonna require proof of vaccine and vaccination, and they're gonna test people, or if you have to show up with a current test, or else they'll test you on the spot. So I guess that's something, but it's still kind of scary. On that happy note, I also mentioned, because when I see all the faces here, and I see a bunch of faces of people who have given me Dana recently, or not even, but have over time, and I don't usually reach out and say thank you directly to people. So I just want to make that a group thank you, that every time I get little notifications, how helpful our phones are. Oh, someone gave me money. It's so nice. And so it's very touching when I see that. So thank you all for supporting me in your ways in that way. And thank you for supporting me and you by showing up here. So someone came on and said it was their first visit. So just to let you know that what we've been doing in this era that we live in is going through my book, One Breath at a Time, little by little. And so we're in step 10. And I'm going to have to start outlining step 11 soon, because we're almost done with step 10. And the piece that I'm on today is called Really Promptly. It's on page 217. And it's taking that word prompt, promptly, from the step 10 says we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And I mean, it's not terribly clever, but I think this is a sort of a typical example of what I did in this book and what I've done trying to connect Buddhism and the 12 steps is to see how this idea of making a prompt inventory and amends connects directly to our meditation practice. It's actually, I guess, obvious in a way, but also pretty striking, really. And I guess, you know, the thing that binds them together is awareness. If you aren't aware that you've harmed someone, then you can't make an amends. You know, you won't know you need to make an amends. But our practice, you know, is one of trying to stay really current with what's happening, and this applies both in a formal period of meditation, when we're, you know, trying to not drift off too much. You know, it's in a way I think we could say that the promptness with which we notice the wandering mind more or less correlates to the amount of concentration that we have in a given moment. What allows us to see it, to catch it, is that our mind is very stable. You know, when we're really stirred up and the mind is drifting everywhere, you know, and with no concentration, we don't realize it, and it's harder to catch that. So at the same time, we have to develop that concentration. So it's in order to be prompt. And so there's this process of continuous returning, which we're all familiar with, of course, because this is the heart of our practice. And of course, in meditation, it's not an amends that we are making in a formal sense. We're not apologizing to ourselves for the having a wandering mind. But if you think of amends as being a healing process, I do think that each time we return, there's a kind of healing that's going on, because in that moment, what we're doing is we're letting go of dukkha. You know, we are letting go of the causes of suffering. We're letting go of some kind of clinging or aversion or resentment or judgment or fear, planning or lost in the past. And each of those moments when we let go, there's a palpable release in the body, in the mind. And so it is a kind of healing, a kind of amends to ourselves. There's a really important part of becoming committed to our practice, becoming committed to meditation, is seeing that dukkha, is seeing the suffering that's created. And that the word suffering is maybe too strong. For a lot of what I'd call dukkha, it's too strong a term. It's very often subtle, but it's that seeing it and tuning in and realizing, oh, this thought that I imagined was useful in some way, or productive or some way, or taking me somewhere useful or meaningful, is actually causing this inner tension. It's actually causing some turmoil inside me. So our mindfulness needs to, you know, develop to actually see that. I think that most people, or at least people who aren't attuned in this way don't realize. I think it's pretty fair to say most people walk around not realizing how much dukkha they are causing themselves with their own minds. And of course, our tendency is then, when we notice that there's dukkha, our tendency is to look outward and blame the world. And so there is this real commitment and really a faith that develops as we start to see how this really works. And so this is one of the key insights, right? One of the starter insights, shall we say, it's not really an easy one to absorb. I mean, if we totally absorb this insight, we just stop. We would stop creating that dukkha, right? If we really just saw it so clearly, and this is the real awakening. Oh, this is just causing me suffering. So that's so important, because if you told most people, oh, you shouldn't think so much, it's causing you suffering, they'd be like, you're crazy. What do you mean I shouldn't think? Of course I need to think. There's nothing wrong with thinking. What are you talking about? So it requires this examination to even see the process. And then once you see the process of how suffering arises through those thoughts, then you have to develop a practice, and you have to train yourself to actually do it, to keep noticing and to keep letting go. And in that process, we discover how stubborn that conditioning is, how stubborn that tendency is to be caught in thought and to believe in thought and to live on the edge of craving, and to be really consumed with craving, which is the normal human state. So there's this in our meditation practice, and then our understanding then, and what we come to understand, is that it's not enough to do this for 20 minutes or an hour or 3 hours a day, however many minutes you meditate each day, that you need to really carry this into the rest of your life, or that otherwise it's just a temporary, momentary relief that doesn't really permeate your life. And so this is where our daily practice, our mindfulness in daily life starts to really, we start to see how important that is, and catching ourselves whenever we can, which, I found that just catching myself a few times a day, maybe a half a dozen times a day, can actually be very impactful. Each time you notice the dukkha arising and you let go of it, there's a whole kind of cleansing that happens in that moment. And it's kind of cleaning the slate, I think. So as I'm talking about this, there's like a little other voice dropping in now and then saying, and how does this relate to addiction? The most obvious way that it relates to addiction is that the craving, if you are still caught in that craving, this, at least helps you to see it. But, I have my sense is that if you are an active addict or someone who is actively engaged in trying to stop, that once craving arises, there's very little hope for reversing it. Maybe that's not true. You know, the old, you know, call your sponsor or go to a meeting. You know, yeah, if you catch it and you take all the steps, absolutely, it can be stopped. But I think what really allows us to, what really supports maintaining our sobriety and you know, not acting on our addiction is getting to the point where the craving doesn't arise. And that's really what I think that this kind of practice can help us with. You know, it's the development of concentration or samadhi. Concentration isn't that great a word. Actually, I'm giving a talk tonight for anybody who's interested in more Kevin. Napa Valley Insight is tonight. I imagine Angela will be able to find that, and put it in the link. And I've been going through the Eightfold Path with them. And this is the eighth talk in that series over the last 8 months. And that last factor of the Eightfold Path is concentration. So I'll be talking about it tonight. But when we really develop concentration, one of its qualities is that it cools the fires, it cools the emotions. So it has a natural and healthy suppressive power, where it naturally suppresses craving, just which totally makes sense when you think about, rather than concentration, to think of it more as calm or peace or relaxed. That in those states, when we're feeling mellow, that we don't have that, we're not caught up in our craving. It's like, so that I think is the greatest protection against relapse. Not going to a million meetings and calling your sponsor every 5 minutes, as valuable as those things can be, when you're on the edge, but so that you don't get to the edge is what we want. You know, we want to develop a mental condition that's tends to be more peaceful. And so this comes back again to the promptness, because when we don't recognize dukkha arising, it tends to replicate. It tends to expand on itself. It tends to feed itself. When some anxiety arises, then a thought starts to come, and then a projection, and then that feeds the anxiety and the fear, and the body is getting tense, and the feelings are, you know, start to become unmanageable. And that at that point we reach for some solution, something to suppress just immediately, the pill or the drink or the drug or whatever the addictive behavior is. Because we can't tolerate it. The other piece of that is that when we cultivate mindfulness, besides the calming or cooling that the concentration can bring, mindfulness creates this other, maybe a little bit less easy to define quality, but that we can call spaciousness, and also we can call it perspective. So this is actually an aspect of equanimity, in which we are able to, in a sense, step away from the feeling and give it more space, so that it's not overwhelming. And So part of this is disidentifying with the feeling, not thinking that is I. And holding it in this sense of spaciousness. And with this is a perspective of wisdom. So seeing it, as we say, through the lens of Dharma. Oh, there is a feeling. You know, our ordinary experience is just we are the feeling. I'm consumed by the feeling. It's taken me over. And so in that relationship, I have to manage or react to the feeling. You know, it's like I'm acting out of the feeling. And if we do, when we can develop mindfulness, then we are outside the feeling in a sense. There we can experience it. We can have this other perspective that can actually just feel the feeling, you know, and realize that we are not consumed by it, but rather that we are holding it rather than it is holding us. And that holding has an element of kindness to it, of compassion. So we're realizing, oh, I am having this painful feeling. That's difficult. You know? And then this disidentification, it's not who I am. I am not this feeling. And of course, the wisdom of impermanence. It's just an energy that's going to come and go. It completely shifts our relationship to it. Always the key, that key. Rather than being consumed by, we are holding it. It's actually a pretty good two different ways of thinking about those experiences of either being, you know, inside the feeling or outside the feeling, or being consumed by the feeling or holding the feeling, that's a good one maybe to remember, you know. Oh, can I just hold this? What does it mean to hold this feeling rather than being held by it? So I'm going to go back to one breath at a time, and maybe that will come back up with you guys. This is just another one of these funny stories. This is another piece that I remember writing this, because I was writing it just shortly after this one experience happened on this retreat. It was actually a kind of teacher training retreat, where I kind of had this embarrassing moment, and it was, as I describe it here, this kind of promptly admitting, like being in this really embarrassing moment where I thought I was right, basically. I thought I was right, and like that I could, that I knew what everybody there wanted. And then when I said that, and that I was trying to tell the teacher they should do something different, and everybody in the group was like, no, we don't want him to do something different. And, you know, a very public, potentially humiliation. It was embarrassing, but yeah, it was really a great experience for me of seeing exactly what I'm talking about, of having this feeling, in this case, embarrassment, come up, a public, you know, embarrassment. I don't want to call it humiliation because it wasn't really that, but I could have made it into that, I guess. But because I was on this in this retreat environment, you know, I had, there was a lot of spaciousness, And it was just striking to me because I don't think I had ever been that much present in it. I know I had never been that present in a situation like that, where there was potential for me to just go into a really bad mood, you know, like a really bad state. Like I could have easily just felt like cringe crawling away. And instead it just was like, oh, okay. Wow, that's embarrassing. Okay. And it just like, it went away. And I saw in that moment, and I described that, maybe I could find that where I said, as it became clear that I had misjudged what people wanted, I felt the terrible embarrassment of public failure. In a matter of seconds, a wide range of emotions appeared in my mind: humiliation, sadness, self-judgment, anger. I saw that my normal reaction to these events and these feelings would be to envelop myself in depression, to start to tell a story to myself about what a jerk I was. But I didn't do it. Instead of following the well-traveled emotional road to depression, I let go. In that moment, I looked ahead, knowing that it was typical for me to have resistance to workshops and exercises, but that whenever I came out the other side, I felt better. Having attended lots of retreats and workshops, I knew that I would look back and say, why did I get so uptight about this? And I would see the experience as a great learning process. So right in that moment where I would typically fall apart or withdraw or get angry and depressed, I just let go of it all. It was like seeing my whole personality structure dissolve before my eyes. All the defenses and fears and self-judgments looked completely pointless, and I didn't let them catch me. I saw through the illusion of self. It's this kind of promptness that insight meditation allows. Yeah. That really was like such an ideal opportunity that I had to go through this really horrible thing, but it just really was powerful. It still stays with me. And I remember I described then we went into pairs to do like a dialogue exercise. And I remember exactly who I was talking to. And I remember exactly that moment when she was like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah. She's like, really? And I was like, yeah, I really am. And, it's just striking. And that was this July of 2003. And of course, I don't want to suggest that that's the way I handle every situation today. I don't think I've ever, again, handled anything quite that way. But it was so illuminating that it left an imprint that I draw from and when I can remember to do it. So, all right, little time left for people who want to chime in. Hope I didn't use up too much time there with you guys.
Got some hands, Kevin.
Oh, yeah, great. Mm-hmm. Which hand went up? Steve, did you put your hand up first? Okay.
I just would like to introduce myself. My name is Steve Jones, and I live in Windsor, California. I'm 70 years old, and I'm a veteran of AA, and I'm a veteran of NA, and I'm currently an active member of FA, and that is my current addiction is food, Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous, and I'm a been participating in refuge recovery meetings, Dharma recovery meetings, and I don't know. I think I have to share that I ran into your material about a year and a half ago. I've been meditating off and on for about 40 years, and then but the last 3 years I've had a real serious commitment to my meditation, and became a serious Buddhist practitioner about a year and a half ago. And I started, somebody turned me on to One Breath at a Time. And after I read that book, I was like completely blown away, because all of a sudden I'm going,
naturally,
God, this guy, this work is just blue. It's just amazing. I've been doing 12-step work and I don't have any cravings for alcohol. I've been sober for about 30 years and I finally got off of the prescription drugs about 3 years ago. But you and I travel the same journey, you know, except for you're a guitar player and I'm a drummer. And so I was just totally so absorbed by your work and how it resonated with me. So then I had to start acquiring all your books and I read everything. And just the way the way you write stuff and the way you present yourself is it speaks volumes to me. And I've got to refine my recovery practice. You know, I'm not going to be long in this earth if I can't get a handle on my eating. I've got 11 stents in my heart, and I think this is what I want to do. So I want to try to assimilate myself into this particular community as softly and smoothly as I can. It just really speaks to me and it resonates with me. And I'm doing too much. You know, I got, like you were just saying, you can call your sponsors, you can go to meetings every single day. You can, you know, sit for hours and hours and hours, but just what you were mentioning is what I really have to do. So thank you for allowing me to share. It's very nice to be here for my first meeting, and I will be sitting with you at on the Spirit Rock session this Saturday for the full day. So blessings to all of you. And I won't be able to make next season. Once my grandson goes into back to school, that's another thing. My daughter's an addict, and so my wife and I are raising my grandson. He's 15 years old. Wow. Through the neglect and everything, he's got a fifth, sixth grade education. So we put him into Huntington Learning Center, and my whole life is dedicated to giving this boy an opportunity to live a good, solid life and not fall into the addiction path that his mom and dad have gone down. So all the support I can get from everyone is greatly appreciated. So that's all I wanted to share. Thank you so much for your time, and blessings to you, Kevin. I just really love your work.
Thanks, Steve. Certainly welcome. You are welcome. Thanks for reminding us that I am going to be teaching that day long with Vimala Sara on Saturday. Yeah. Carol, hi.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much, Kevin, for that talk today. You know, they say when you go to a meeting, you're going to hear exactly what you need to hear. and that was it. A week ago, my family had this huge blow up and they're just splintered all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I had several nights of, you know, not sleeping, being up, having this go over and over in my mind, what's going on and not knowing what to do with it. And then after about 3 days in, I thought, you know what, I have some muscle relaxers and that'll help me not think about this and I can get some sleep. Now, my drug of choice is alcohol. I never did pills. I never did any other drugs. But I thought to myself, this, if I do this, this is one step away from me taking a drink to numb these feelings. And it really scared me. And I was able to share this out loud at a couple of meetings later that week. And, you know, because when it rattles around in my head, it becomes bigger than it is. And, you know, I just needed to get it out. So, you know, I ended up writing some things and, you know, I vowed to let the craving go and not to need what I think I need from this whole splintering of the family. But this morning I did a meditation from Plum Village about embracing unpleasant feelings. And I realized I don't need to let them go. I need to live with them and sit with them. And, you know, what you said about, can I hold this feeling rather than hold me? That was really huge. So, you know, the meditation this morning that I did about enduring these feelings, that's, you know, I need to take the weight of it being such a monster away. And I need to just recognize it for what it is and live with it. So anyway, it's work in progress. But thank you again. I heard what I needed to hear today. And that was just huge for me. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Carol. Sorry about the family stuff. That's so difficult. Ugh, yeah. Joe.
Hi, Kevin. So what really struck me about what you said today was your little description about how you move from something happening to depression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, having moved into depression so many times in my life, it's a familiar story, but the way you described it, and I realized that the same, I don't want to get technical here, but for me, this is real. The same steps of dependent origination mm-hmm. follow in this as well.
That's right.
And in a way, it's clinging to that negative experience.
Yes, it is.
You know, that leads to being born into it and going the mm-hmm. whole nine yards.
Yep.
And it was just an eye-opener. It was an eye-opener to see. I mean, I watched you in your description go straight in there. And hence, I can now see it in myself, too. So it's just wonderful. It's just so important to gain that perspective. And that's why we listen to each other.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. And, you know, and as I was reading that, I was like, oh, this is funny that, I'm not so much funny, but that I wondered if some people would be wondering how I got from what was kind of humiliating into depression. And so I just want to say that someone else might have gone into a different emotion, but it was just, that's the way my conditioning, and that's my tendency. Someone else from that really difficult situation, this embarrassing situation, might have gone into anxiety or anger or blame. But whatever it is, it'd be the thing that you tend to do, right? So for me, it's depression. And it's just so, just as you were describing, dependent origination is exactly it. And, you know, there are 12 aspects traditionally in dependent origination. And when someone asked Ajahn Chah about dependent origination, about trying to like be mindful of it, he said, you really can't. It's like seeing all the steps in dependent origination is like falling out of a tree and counting the branches as you've come towards the ground. It happens so fast. But that's exactly what I was sort of describing in this short piece, that I wasn't seeing all the stages, but I was seeing the ground and I knew that I was moving toward it, you know? So I felt that creation happening, that dependent origination happening in that moment. And I was able to, and that was enough, you know, to interrupt it. Cause the truth is I wasn't really falling out of a tree. It's like Joseph Goldstein says, there's a moment when you get deeply into practice where you realize that you've jumped out of an airplane without a parachute. And then you look down, you realize, oh, well, there's no earth. So it's like, that's kind of the thing. It's like, well, oh my God, like, I'm going to fall into this thing. Oh, there's nothing to fall on. Oh, and that, of course, that's a not self. That's the letting go of self, of creating self that gets created in dependent origination. And just as, you know, I'm saying, it's like, it looks like something that's inevitable and we keep creating it, but it actually isn't inevitable at all. It can be broken because it's all a creation of the mind.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which is easy to say. It requires vigilance. So, well, that was fun. You know, it's interesting. I knew there was something else I wanted to say this morning. We'll for those who are going to hang out for a minute more, we'll do a little metta practice. Our dear friend and regular Vicky is undergoing some surgery today. And I spoke to her yesterday and talked with her about her feelings about that, which were difficult feelings. I also told her that and asked her if it was okay to tell the group. And she was, you know, very, very positive about that. And I told her that we would do some metta for her. So it's quite likely she's on the East Coast, but it's quite likely that she's, in the operating room right now, or else coming out of, it's an outpatient procedure, but serious enough. So let's just do some metta as a closing. So just settle back for a moment. If you don't know Vicky, you can just have her name in your mind. But if you've seen her, she's been on here a great deal. She's got a wonderful smile. One of the people who laughs and smiles a lot during these teachings. So opening your own heart and sending healing energy, caring energy to Vicky. May she be safe. Protected. May she be healed. May she be free from fear and from physical and mental pain. And sharing those wishes with all beings, including ourselves and each other. May all beings be safe and peaceful. May all beings be free from suffering.